Thanks for joining us for today's Political Rewind. We're pleased to have you listening. You know, we're going to divert just a little bit from the news of the day because we know that you really have enjoyed in the past when we tried to put the news in historical context. And that's exactly what we want to do around impeachment today, is talk about it as an example of extreme partisanship in action right now, but talk about how partisanship has developed over the decades. And we'll look at some key moments in how partisanship really was propelled forward. Tamar Hallerman is with us. She is the Washington correspondent, of course, for the AJC, right here in our studio, not on the telephone, not on that little interesting microphone that you bought to plug into your laptop. You're here.
It happens once in a blue moon.
Really glad you are. And as long as we're talking to you, would you like to share your big announcement with our listeners?
I'm moving to Atlanta after 12 years in D.C. and 4 as the AJC's Washington correspondent, taking a new role with the paper. We're going to hire a new Washington correspondent who I'll introduce to you guys soon.
Good.
In the meantime, taking a new kind of interdisciplinary role at the paper, hoping to do more in-depth stuff, looking at policy, looking at gender, looking at the culture wars, urban-rural
divide.
What
a great thing for you to get to do. So, like six Republican members of the House from Texas, you too are abandoning Washington.
It's time.
All right. We're also joined by Dr. Joe Crispino, who is the Jimmy Carter Professor of American History at Emory University. Joe, you've been on the show before, and when you do come in and help put things in historical context, our listeners always appreciate it. I also, in introducing you, always like to say, you are the author of the biography of Atticus Finch.
That's right. It's called Atticus Finch, the biography, Harper Lee, her father, and the making of American icon.
Now, we've done a show on it, and in fact, you can, if you go on the Two-Way Street website, actually, you can find that interview that Joe and I did back when the book was first published. But essentially, what you did with that book is to incorporate the differences that Harper Lee wrote into her first, you know, the first book, the book in which Atticus Finch became a great hero, and then Go Set a Watchman, where suddenly we found him to be a very different kind of character.
Yeah, and To Kill a Mockingbird, he is the noble defender, the downtrodden, the great hero, one of the great heroes of American literature. And in Go Set a Watchman, this novel that was discovered and published in 2015, he's exactly what you think, you know, a 70-year-old arthritic white man would be like in South Alabama in the mid-50s, right? So, you know, all those people who had named their kids Atticus or their dog Atticus, you know, up in arms. And, you know, this uses history and literary history, political history to make sense of all that.
It's a terrific book. All right, let's talk tomorrow. Just for, you know, for a moment, let me point out the impeachment news of the day. George P. Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State who's in charge of Ukraine policy, is up on Capitol Hill today testifying behind closed doors about whatever he knows about the Ukraine scandal, which I think it's safe to say is a fair word to use in talking about it. And he becomes yet another member of the administration, like Fiona Hill yesterday, who have decided that despite the administration, the White House efforts to stop anyone from the administration from testifying, decided they've got to come forward and speak. So I wonder, Tamar, I know that Congress is just getting back in session today. You're down here, so you haven't talked to him today, any of the Georgia members. But if administration officials are starting to break ranks, do we have any reason to think that the Republicans who have been so staunch in their defense of the president are going to start doing the same?
Not at the moment, based on what we've seen so far. And if anything, from the members who have been vocal, and let's put people into two categories. All of the Republicans, first of all, have said right now they don't see enough for any sort of impeachable offense. But you have the folks who would kind of rather not talk about it and keep their distance, and you have the folks who really have rallied to the president's defense. And, you know, the ones who have been vocal about it have become more vocal over the last 2 weeks when they were back in their districts. We especially saw Jody Heiss, arguably the most conservative member of the delegation, a member of the Freedom Caucus allied with Jim Jordan, really kind of start going after Adam Schiff, the chairman in charge of the Intelligence Committee.
But the others, you know, they all know you, obviously. They recognize you when you're down the hall. Are they turning around and walking the other way when they see you down there? Are they avoiding you?
No, if anything. And there are some exceptions. It seems like Johnny Isaacson would rather talk about other things. Yeah. He wants to start doing legislation and that sort of thing. But the rest really want to show that despite what they've seen so far, that they aren't buying it. And none of them are on the Intelligence Committee, first of all, so none of them are getting to sit in these closed-door meetings. But people like Doug Collins, the top Republican on the Judiciary Committee, potential candidate for U.S. Senate, if anything, you see him continue to go on cable news and talk about how he doesn't see anything wrong.
But and Joe, you're welcome to weigh in on this,
sure,
too. But what is fascinating about Doug Collins is when it was the Judiciary Committee that was the center of activity, when Nadler was running the hearings, Collins had a great platform to speak out strongly against what Democrats were doing. But now that things have shifted to intelligence, Collins is, he can still go on the cable shows, but he's sidelined in terms of being an active participant in the committee meetings.
Exactly. And there's a real question of whether it'll come back to the Judiciary Committee after all of this. In theory, they have jurisdiction over impeachment matters, but it seems like Pelosi's really shifted the venue. You can argue whether that's a good or a bad thing for Doug Collins as he's trying to get this Senate appointment. On the one hand, he wants the president to be on his side, to see him on cable news, think he's doing a good job. At the same time, he can kind of turn and start focusing on his own messaging, whatever he wants, and trying to convince Kemp and the president to try and appoint him.
Yeah, I've said this on the show before, Joe, and you're welcome to weigh in if you'd like to. Nadler, I think because of some of the real problems he had in keeping control over the Judiciary Committee, the Corey Lewandowski hearing being a particular example of how they were just run roughshod by Lewandowski. It's not surprising that Nancy Pelosi decided when they really started getting serious about impeachment, she'd shift the focus to an Adam Schiff, former prosecutor, guy who's disciplined, seems to know how to run things. You know, he's made some stupid mistakes. We've talked about those. His talking in gangster language about how Trump dealt with a phone call with Zelensky. But he does seem to be a guy that Pelosi would rather invest trust in right now.
Yeah, Schiff seems to be really well prepared to deal with these hearings. And he also, you know, has an active presence on social media. Then he kind of goes toe-to-toe with the president, which seems to be, you know, one of the few Democrats who are willing or able to do that. So, it does seem like a calculated move on Pelosi's part.
All right, so let's shift over to this conversation about how impeachment represents, I think it's safe to say, one of the most extreme examples you could have of partisanship. If we go back just in recent past history, Joe, there was a move to impeach George W. Bush. These things didn't get terribly far, but they were in the atmosphere. They were in the ether. People were talking about them, that George W. Bush, for any number of reasons, some Democrats felt should be impeached. Some liberals, leaders out in the communities around the country thought he should be impeached, partly over Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction, which didn't turn up. Then there was a move to impeach President Obama. Again, not a major effort, but there was a lot of talk about Obama ought to be impeached for a variety of issues there as well. So it's not as if impeachment hasn't been out there as a part of the conversation. And of course, it's been driven by partisan politics through these last three administrations.
Sure. Yeah. When people sometimes talk to me about partisanship today, hyper-partisanship today, and they say, you know, well, has it ever been this? Aren't we in a unique moment? Has it ever been this bad? And of course, I always say, yeah, it's been worse. There was that war back in the 19th century and all. So we have seen this before, and it has been worse than we have it now. Yet it is true that if you look over the last, really over the last 25 years, but certainly, you know, you can date it back to the middle of the 20th century, there has been a noticeable rise, and this is driven by a variety of factors, you know, social changes, technological changes, political changes, you know, and individuals, particular individuals have played important roles too.
I want to go back in history and look at some of the moments that we're going to talk about. But before I do, Tamar, when you hear the vitriol with which Republicans are talking about Democrats about Republicans on the Hill these days, I mean, this is a relatively small club, the House of Representatives, and certainly the Senate, 100 men and women. Are they able to talk to each other when the cameras aren't rolling? Or has this partisanship become even more difficult for them to deal with in interpersonal relationships?
It's become more difficult, and you see a real generational difference. You see folks who've been in the chamber for especially in the Senate, because you really do, it's designed that you need to get consensus across the aisle. That's what the filibuster kind of is designed to help do. You see the older folks who've been around a long time who understand, okay, I'm going to have to give a little to get a little on these. And you get these newer folks who have come up in these much more partisan times where they don't realize, oh, wait, that's really important. And sometimes it takes a while to get there for a lot of them. What also is so striking is you forget there are all these rules in place to keep decorum. So that's what's so jarring sometimes is they still are required to talk, you know, my dear friend from so-and-so. And but at the same time, you can tell behind the scenes there's such backstabbing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot.
All right, let's go. Wait,
go ahead. That's interesting, and that's a change. I mean, when we're talking about the many changes that feed partisanship, it's just, you know, if you go back to the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, representatives used to move to D.C. with their families, and families knew each other. And you had, you know, wives who were friends with wives across political divisions, and that has all changed, you know, within the last 20 years.
That is so important. Cokie Roberts and I had a big conversation about that not long ago, and of course she comes out of one of the most significant Democratic political families in American government, and she used to talk about that, how her parents were both up. Lindy Boggs, Hale Boggs, the majority leader in the House, her mom who took his seat when he was tragically killed in a crash, they all lived in Washington. And as you say, they all socialized with each other across party lines. And things are entirely different now.
And that was a big change we saw under Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker, is one of the things he said is, when you're in Washington, you're only mingling with the elite. You're out of touch with your district. So he encouraged everyone to fly back home at the end of every week. So now on Capitol Hill, they only really work, you know, when members of Congress are on the ground, it's only about 3.5 days
a
week.
Yeah, they maybe come in Monday night.
Monday night, they usually are gone.
Thursday, they don't want to vote on Friday, right?
Exactly. And so people are immediately rushing home to their districts, rushing home to their corners, and they aren't getting to know people from the other side. You know, even when they are on Capitol Hill, they're fundraising, they're doing social things only with their side of the aisle. So unless they end up going on a think tank sponsored trip abroad, or a committee hearing, they really aren't ever getting to spend quality time with the other side.
So let's go back in time, Joe, and begin talking about how things started to change. One of the things that you've pointed out is that one of the things that allowed for more collegial conversation and an ability for members of Congress to resolve issues working together is that there was a time when the parties themselves, each party, might represent a fairly broad spectrum of political thought. So you had Republicans.
Absolutely, yeah. So as late as the mid-20th century, 1950s, 1960s, you know, you had conservative Democrats and you had liberal Republicans. And this is because the parties evolved out of the 19th century that were based on kind of regional coalitions that date back, you know, in some cases to the early Republic. But what happens beginning in the middle of the 20th century is both parties begin, there are activists within both parties who are trying to move to a more British model where there's a conservative party and a liberal party. Now, argue in scholars debate who is the first, who's responsible for this. In some ways, you could date this to the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt has liberal kitchen cabinet who wants to move the party more discernibly to the left, and so famously in 1938, FDR. Controversially campaigns against Democratic senators in the Democratic primary. Here in Georgia, he campaigned, when he was down in Georgia for one of his at the little White House, he campaigns against Walter George. He tries to get some unseated. elected, does the same thing against Cotton Ed Smith in South Carolina, both of whom were very staunch conservative Democrats who had been opponents of a lot of the New Deal legislation.
And you can take that back. You said it a moment ago. The conservative Southern Democrats, like a Walter George, as you said, you can trace that back to 19th century roots when there were geopolitical coalitions. You pointed out in a lecture that the Midwest had business leaders, industrialists,
right,
and others in the North who tended to be Republicans in those days. The South had an agrarian society, farmers, rural people who in those days were Democrats, but conservative Democrats.
Yeah, and that was one of the big, you know, kind of political economic divisions within the country, kind of industrializing Midwest and Northeast versus the rural agricultural base South and West. And that was kind of one of the divisions, main rivalries within Democrat politics.
So, Tamar, great examples of the kind of ideological diversity you might have found in each party. You'd have a Nelson Rockefeller, who many today would be considered a liberal Democrat. I mean, excuse me, he was in many ways a very liberal Republican. And then on the other hand, you had who's a great example of a much more conservative Republican from back in those—
Robert Taft.
Okay, Robert Taft. Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. On the Democratic side, you had a Richard Russell here in Georgia— very conservative Democrat, a Harry Byrd in West Virginia. But then you also had more liberal Democrats back in the day as well.
Yeah, Hubert Humphrey.
We don't see that at all today, do we, Tamara?
Not nearly as much. And in the Senate, anytime you see somebody closer to the center, those are the people being so heavily targeted in primaries. Just talk to Susan Collins. Talk to somebody like Joe Manchin. People from both parties, you know, who are being targeted by, you know, people of their, you know, in their own base getting primaried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I was just to fill out the thought on, you know, some people would date it to the Democrats in the 30s, but I think a real turning point on the right and for Republicans is the election of Dwight Eisenhower in 1952, because that's the first time you've got a Republican in four presidential election cycles. And there are a lot of people like Bob Taft from Ohio who say, you know, we want to roll back the New Deal. You know, that we never were for it. It's socialism. We want to roll it back. And Eisenhower doesn't do that. Eisenhower makes his peace with the New Deal, and he, you know, advances what he calls a kind of modern republicanism. And this really creates this vacuum that you begin to see the rise of what is the modern conservative movement. And it's driven as much by kind of thought leaders as it is by politicians themselves. You have the founding of the National Review in 1955, which becomes the kind of the voice of the modern conservative movement. William F. Buckley, of course, plays a huge role in that.
Just put it what you said in context. You had four terms of FDR, obviously,
yeah,
the New Deal, liberal politics, followed by Harry Truman, who was there until Dwight Eisenhower. So when you say that Eisenhower was the first Republican to be on a ticket, that really is the context in which we put that.
Absolutely.
And so where in there does the John Birch Society was born in the 50s as well, yes? Am I right about that?
Yes, the John Birch Society was born in the late 50s.
Oh, okay.
Out of a kind of a popular anti-communism, you know. And, of course, the John Birch Society is what the birther movement is kind of, you know, took its name from, or at least was named from by journalists. So, yeah. And that was an interesting moment within the history of modern conservatism, because with the rise of the Birchers, you have a more established conservative movement with people like Buckley, who are very concerned about kind of these folks on the far right who were calling Earl Warren a communist,
yeah,
and you're calling
Supreme Court.
Yeah,
Chief Justice.
Yeah, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And putting up, billboards along roadsides all across the country, you know, that Earl Warren is a communist and that, you know, Dwight Eisenhower may not be a communist, but he's a dupe. He's a communist dupe. So this kind of crazy talk was the kind of thing that more mainstream conservatives, you know, wanted to tamp down and had to get control of. And so Buckley and others at the National Review play an important role in trying to do that.
Yeah, I think, Tamar, if I realize that this was so far before you were even born that this is ancient history. Well, for Crispino, too, I should say.
Yes, I was not alive then either, thank you.
But so I'm the only one to remember. But I think that William F. Buckley would roll in his grave right now if he heard Crispino talking about Buckley and the Nation in the same terms that he's talking about birthers. The John Birch Society, yeah. And birthers. And the reason I point that out is that Buckley represents, you know, the Birch Society, both of these were influences on the Republican Party and on the partisanship that started growing. So that's why I mentioned this. Buckley was the intellectual side of conservatism. Buckley was the guy who tried to make intellectual points about the value of conservative thought, whereas the Birch Society was basically an organization of haters who were looking to undermine anything they saw as vaguely liberal.
And you're seeing that push and pull still in the Republican Party today and kind of who's controlling the messaging. You're seeing it now when the Weekly Standard recently shut down. They were pretty, I don't know if never Trump is the word, but they were skeptical of Trump. And now, you know, you saw for a while the rise of Breitbart News, a lot more populist and kind of fully behind the president. And the National Review is still around, but I don't know if you can put that into more context, Professor. But yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the things I want to push back a little bit on your characterization of Buckley.
You think Buckley was not the intellectual I'm painting him as?
No. Buckley became, you know, this kind of eminent Greece on the right,
yeah.
You know, and he kind of, you know, became a much more kind of moderating figure. But let's remember, Buckley writes God in Yale. That's the book. He'd gone to Yale and talks about all the liberal professors at Yale. And then he writes a book explicitly defending Joseph McCarthy.
Yeah.
You know, he
yeah.
writes, that's, I mean, he's defending Joe McCarthy. Then he goes on to found National Review. And when he founds National Review, who's writing for the National Review? A lot of Southern segregationist Democrats. Richard Russell writes for the National Review early on. He's explicitly defending segregation. And the exclusion of African American voters during the 1957 debates over the Civil Rights Bill. So, you know, Buckley, you know, like all these people evolve over time and become different things. And that's what as historians are trying to do, to remember that, you know, Buckley was pretty far there out there when he first made his start.
Thank you. I'm really glad you made that point, because I guess what probably I should have said is that Buckley would have styled himself
yes.
as the intellectual of
Absolutely.
The right, whether
yeah.
or not, I mean, we can go back, and in fact, we ought to post a link, if we can, to this for our listeners. You can go back and look at the famous, infamous Gore-Vidal,
yeah.
William F. Buckley debate on Crossfire, whatever it was in those days. And it's a great example of what you're talking about, the liberal Vidal doing battle with the conservative Buckley, who does show his true stripes, I think, in that debate. Let's do this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about the enormous influence that Richard Nixon and the attempt to impeach him and his ultimate resignation as president had in creating a partisanship in the Republican Party that persists to this day. We'll be right back with more.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Ooh, drive away. Ooh, drive so far.
Tonight in Ohio, 12 Democratic presidential hopefuls meet on one stage. Will the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump dominate the night? I'm Audie Cornish. Find out where the candidates stand, who will shine and who will clash. The CNN New York Times Democratic presidential debate, available live on CNN or listen here from NPR News.
Join us tonight from 8 to 11 here on GPB and on gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Joe Crispino, Emory University professor of American history, is with us, and Tamar Hellerman, currently the Washington correspondent for AJC, but soon to be an Atlanta correspondent covering a multitude of policy issues and more. Fair way to say it?
Hell yeah.
Okay. let's keep talking about partisanship and how it developed and got to the point where it now feels completely out of control. Joe, it's interesting to look back on Richard Nixon. Because I think if you don't really study, think about Nixon independent from the resignation, the Watergate and all that stuff, it might be easy to overlook the fact that Richard Nixon was actually the last moderate Republican president that we've had in office. I mean, you could say Gerald Ford maybe, but he was so short-lived. Right. He was part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Those conservatives that I was talking about, you know, they were very skeptical of Richard Nixon. You know, Richard Nixon got his start as a right-wing anti-communist,
right,
you know, out of Southern California. And that's what, you know, he was put on the ticket in 52, was Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years. But say on the signature issue of, say, civil rights in the 1950s and 60s, he breaks a filibuster, he breaks a tie in the voting over the 57 Civil Rights Bill. He courts, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. when he's running for president in 1960 and other African-American voters, you know, and he's seen as a kind of more moderate. And so those conservatives in the party are skeptical of them. And one of the ways he wins them over is by him using increasingly, you know, language of law and order by 1966, 67, and 68. But he's still not seen as a true conservative. And certainly when he gets into the presidency, the way he opens up towards China, the way he conducts foreign policy with Henry Kissinger, drives a lot of conservatives crazy. And so, yeah, there were big rifts between kind of the conservative wing of the Republican Party and Richard Nixon.
Before, I have not looked at our social media feeds yet today, tomorrow, but before I start looking and see everybody saying, how can you say those things about Richard Nixon? I'm not suggesting that because he was viewed in the party as a more moderate force, that he wasn't, in fact, a dark force as well, because his law and order campaigns, as you point out, some of his early history, the famous race against Helen Gagan Douglas in California, where he went after his Democratic opponent with just tooth and nail lies about who she was. So I'm not suggesting Nixon was some brave moderate, but he is in many ways. He was much more moderate than much of the party in his presidency.
Yeah, and you look at studies over time about how far both parties have drifted to one side. There was a great Pew study we pulled up from 2016 that showed just how over time both sides have really kind of polarized, and that's for a variety of reasons that I'm sure we'll get into later.
We're going to talk about them.
Exactly.
Well, Watergate is one of them. And, you know, and what's interesting about Watergate is terrible for the Republican Party. You know, when Nixon resigns in August of 74, they lose huge numbers of seats in the midterm elections in 74. And of course, you know, many Republicans will say Jimmy Carter's elected in 76 exactly because of the fallout over Watergate. But Watergate is very good for conservatives within the Republican Party. That's the important difference.
Because?
Well, because it affirms a certain narrative that conservatives had been running on for years, which is that Washington is corrupt. Washington is full of, you know, the establishment is corrupt. And so this kind of anti-Washington, anti-government kind of message that is at the core, one of the pillars of modern conservative politics, gets confirmed in interesting ways through the Watergate scandal.
Okay, so let's listen to just a little bit of Richard Nixon's resignation speech. This is the speech that he gives, I think it's August 9th, 1974, in which he says, the punchline is, tomorrow at noon, I will surrender the White House. And this is what he says at one point during this speech.
As we look to the future, the first essential is to begin healing the wounds of this nation, to put the bitterness and divisions of the recent past behind us, and to rediscover those shared ideals that lie at the heart of our strength and unity as a great and as a free people. By taking this action, I hope that I will have hastened the start of that process of healing which is so desperately needed in America. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness toward those who have opposed me.
Tamar, I find that fascinating. I mean, I suppose you could argue that once he left office, there was some kind of healing in the sense that people were no longer bitterly fighting over whether Richard Nixon was a criminal or not. But his notion that we are somehow now going to, he hopes that we come together and learn how to work together. He has no bitterness towards his enemies. It's really fascinating to hear that, isn't it?
Exactly. And kind of given the context of where we are today with our current occupant in the White House, who is very different from all his predecessors in so many ways, but no apologies, never, never admit to any sort of wrongdoing. You would never hear those words today.
Well, but also, Joe, that didn't happen.
Well, one thing important to remember, it wasn't clear whether or not Nixon would be open for prosecution at this point.
That's exactly right.
And it's only until Ford pardons him that that's taken off the table.
Yes.
And so that becomes a real albatross for Ford. But listening to that quote, my gosh, it sounds so quaint almost. This idea that there are these shared values, that there are, you know, a certain kind of comedy to American political life that is necessary. I mean, you're right, Tamar. I mean, it's hard to imagine a lot of people. And of course, the other thing that we've got to remember about the current impeachment process and what happened with Nixon is that, you know, Nixon was impeached because Republicans broke.
Yeah, that's why I started the show by asking whether there might be a break in the ranks at any point.
That's right. But in that, we see no evidence of that happening at this point in the process.
So, all right, so we know that in the aftermath of Nixon, the conservatives, it does strike me that a lot of the history of partisanship, and Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, because, you know, you were very generous in sharing with us the notes from a lecture you gave on this. An awful lot of it has to do with Republican movement, not quite as much with Democrats moving one way or the other, or if I got that wrong.
Well, both parties have moved, but Republicans have moved dramatically.
Okay. I mean, Democrats are entrenched also. It isn't as if they are now, you know, practicing what Nixon claims to have wanted to see, reaching out and comedy and all that.
That's right.
But it is the movement of the Republican Party that really is fascinating to track.
What you see, and what's notable too about on the right is the way that there are individuals who are kind of the forerunners of this kind of scorched earth, divisive political rhetoric. And we saw it in Newt Gingrich, but we also saw it before, you know, in some ways before Gingrich with Pat Buchanan.
There you go. But let's go to Newt Gingrich because he's fascinating. So Nixon is gone. Ford has been in office. He's fatally wounded with the pardon of Nixon, and Jimmy Carter wins election in 1976. By then, Newt Gingrich, by 1978, Newt had tried and lost two bids for Congress. He finally won in November of 1978. But I want to read from, and then get both of you to react to, I want to read a paragraph of a speech that Newt gave to the College of Republicans at the Holiday Inn at the Atlanta airport on June 24th, 1978, because, boy, Tamar, this really tells us something about the way in which the Republicans were moving to the right and would later be led by the man who's making these remarks. He said to the students, "Do you like the state of the Republican Party? Do you think Bill Brock, who was a leader at the time, has done such a great job? Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, the only incumbent president since Hubert Hoover to lose an election, they have done a terrible job, a pathetic job. In my lifetime, literally in my lifetime, I was born in 1943. We have not had a competent national Republican leader, not ever. We had some guys who were too embarrassing, but what's the primary purpose of a political leader above anything else? In this system, it's to build a majority capable of sustaining itself, because if we don't do that, we don't make the laws, we don't write the taxes, we don't decide how to start a war, we don't keep the country strong, And he goes on from there. This is Gingrich running as a Republican in 1978.
And one thing to mention, you know, Newt Gingrich, when he first came to Congress, he was one of the first people to take advantage of this brand new service or technology that had been unveiled, C-SPAN. All these technology or cable companies came together to sponsor, you know, they're going to put cameras, first of all, only on the House floor. And Newt was one of the first people to see the value in that, where as a total freshman, or maybe he was a sophomore, a complete backbencher, the value of going on to the Senate or the House floor at maybe 9 o'clock p.m., the chamber is empty, and just pontificating, talking about whatever he wants. But he realized, I can connect to all sorts of conservatives, not even just in my district, but around the country.
It was, these were special orders, which members of the House could request speech, time to speak from the well when the House isn't in session. And Joe, it's wonderful she points that out, because, of course, initially, it was a tight shot of the speaker, whoever he or she was, in the well. We didn't see the rest of the chamber,
right.
But that was changed, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's changed before. You can see more who's in the speak as well. Yeah,
tomorrow you may know.
He got into a huge fight with Tip O'Neill, because Tip got really annoyed at all these speeches where he slammed whatever the Democrats were doing. And at some point, you know, so the cameras are C-SPAN's cameras, but they are actually controlled by the House, by the House leaders. And so he got the cameras to pan out and show the empty chamber. He wasn't talking to anyone.
Well, and the other thing that Gingrich is doing is, you know, C-SPAN is a product of cable news, right? And so what cable news creates, the 24-hour news cycle. And so he's also very adept at manipulating the media. And, you know, he talks, there's a famous quote of his about how the media responds to conflict. You know, and so, you know, when you create conflict, you're going to draw the eyes of folks like you guys, right? And they're gonna put microphones in front of his face, and he's going to be able to shape the narrative. And that's what he does. He does that. He uses C-SPAN, but he also uses cable media, too.
And in a big moment, there was a face-off fairly early after that, you know, where he did face off against Tip O'Neill. He had said he was criticizing, I can't remember, some Democratic, there was some sort of letter writing between some Democrats in Congress and the government of Nicaragua or some kind of banana republic sort of regime. And, you know, Tip O'Neill was so furious. He came onto the House floor and he said some not nice things about Newt Gingrich. And Newt, realizing that he can get media to cover him if there's conflict, he goes, I'm going to strike the last word of the speaker. I'm going to go toe-to-toe with him. And guess what? He won in that procedural battle in a weird bit of history. 40 years later, or whenever that was, Doug Collins did the same thing on the House floor recently with Nancy Pelosi.
That's exactly right. It is important to point out that in 1978, 79, 80, whatever, Newt Gingrich was a minority party backbencher. It seems to me, Joe, that the last thing you want to do is, if you have a choice, is go up to Congress, be a member of the House in the minority party, and be a relatively unimportant member of your party in those days. And Gingrich learned how to capitalize on it. And one of the ways he did it was by continuing to promote harsher and harsher rhetoric toward Democrats.
And one of his breakthrough moments is, too, the role he played in the removal of Jim Wright as Speaker of the House. And there's a great new book you've got to have by a friend of mine who teaches at Princeton, Julian Zelzer. You've got to have him on your show. And the book comes out in the spring, but it's going to be an important new book that kind of looks at a key moment for his emergence here.
Yeah, and Gingrich instituted a whole multitude of changes that really did kind of change the climate up there. Not only are you expected to be in D.C. less, to trash talk the other party, there's also, you take away, you add term limits for committee chairs, so not only that, you're getting people who don't have as much expertise in those roles. He ended up concentrating a lot more power in the
leadership.
This is
once he became Speaker.
Once he became Speaker,
right.
Make more of the decisions among him and his staff, less decentralized. Not only that, but over time, and we can talk about this in a minute, all these Supreme Court decisions on fundraising that kind of opened the floodgates, but more and more demand to do that. So when you are in Washington, you're constantly raising funds rather than legislating.
Let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way, because when we come back, I do want to spend a little time. We'll catch up to the later years of the partisan battles, but I do want to talk about Pat Buchanan's seminal speech at the 1992 Republican convention in Houston. We'll do that after this break.
My name is Dana Brown. I am the program manager at the Georgia Adoption Reunion Registry. Our goal is to help persons impacted by adoption experience healthy reconnections to impact healthy well-being. We underwrite with GPB because of your extensive listening audience that covers the state of Georgia. It's an effective way to get the word out about what we do across the state of Georgia.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Ronan Farrow. His investigation into Harvey Weinstein's predatory behavior, published in The New Yorker, won a Pulitzer Prize. In his new book, Farrow reports on how Weinstein and Farrow's former employer, NBC, tried to prevent Farrow from publishing or broadcasting the story. Farrow also reports a new allegation against Matt Lauer. Join us.
Fresh Air, coming up this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB, and online at gpbnews.org.
Couple of quick updates on impeachment stories before we continue with our conversation. House Democratic leaders are, everybody's back on the Hill today, and House Democratic leaders are now starting to take the temperature of their caucus as to whether the party should stage a floor vote to launch an official impeachment inquiry, which they haven't done and which the administration has tried to use against them.
Exactly. Tomorrow. And so far, you've seen from a lot of the Republican defenders of Trump on Capitol Hill, less about whether Trump actually did a lot of these things when it comes to Ukraine, but they were really fighting the Democrats on procedural grounds. You're not following the typical procedure. At the same time, Democrats, Pelosi, when she came to the AJC about 2 weeks ago, mentioned that the Constitution is pretty vague about requirements, and it really is up to the discretion of the Speaker, she argues, in terms of whether they have a floor vote or not.
Another quick note. Here's a surprise, Joe. Rudy Giuliani has said that he will not comply with subpoenas to either give documents or testify in front of the committees that are investigating all this.
I'm shocked.
All right. I want to go to 1992 because, Joe, you and I, in talking about this show, talked about what an important moment this was for Republicans and what it did to the landscape of American politics. 1992. We're in Houston because it's basically George H.W. Bush's hometown. It's his convention because he's running for re-election, but he's fought a vicious primary fight. He's fought off a vicious fight by Pat Buchanan, who beats him in New Hampshire, but then cannot win the nomination. And because Buchanan has done so well, he is given a prime spot on the program. And he makes a speech that has become infamous to this day. I want to listen. We're going to listen to a couple minutes of it because it was such an important moment, and then talk about it.
What a terrific crowd this is. What a terrific crowd. This may even be larger than the crowd I had in Ellijay, Georgia. Don't laugh. We carried Ellijay. Like many of you, last month, I watched that giant masquerade ball up at Madison Square Garden, where 20,000 liberals and radicals came dressed up as moderates and centrists in the greatest single exhibition of cross-dressing in American political history. George Bush is a defender of right to life and a champion of the Judeo-Christian values and beliefs upon which America was founded. Mr. Clinton, however, has a different agenda. At its top is unrestricted abortion on demand. Yet a militant leader of the homosexual rights movement could rise at that same convention and say, Bill Clinton and Al Gore represent the most pro-lesbian and pro-gay ticket in history, and so they do. Friends, this election is about more than who gets what. It is about who we are. It is about what we believe and what we stand for as Americans. There is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America. And in that struggle for the soul of America, Clinton and Clinton are on the other side, and George Bush is on our side.
Pat Buchanan at the 1992 Republican Convention in Houston. Joe and Tamara, I do have to tell you something. I listened to that speech again early this morning, and what was interesting to me about it was that I was in the Cox TV booth the night of that speech in Houston, and sitting there watching it down there on the floor, we were kind of all had our mouths hanging open. We were so shocked by the language Buchanan was using in this speech, as were many people in the hall, even Republicans who supported, maybe particularly Republicans who supported George H.W. Bush. When I listened to it this morning, I thought, well, kind of the way we're all talking these
days. With the exception of him saying pro-lesbian and pro-gay, it's shockingly similar. When you talk about abortions on demand, you hear Republicans now talking about Democrats wanting late-term abortions and it's okay, you know, infanticide would be okay under the Democratic regime. Very much our side versus theirs, the exact kind of rhetoric you hear now.
But it was shocking.
Shocking.
It was shocking for Republicans, you know. And the classic quote about it was from Molly Ivins, the Texas political reporter. She said she liked it better in the original German. But that's right. That there, it was. It's a measure of how you know coarsened we've become. To think about, you know, how upsetting this speech was to so many people, not just on the left, but people within the Republican Party. And George Bush says that that's what caused him to lose the election.
Yeah.
That speech is the thing that, you know, that really hurt him in the general election against Bill Clinton.
You want to know how resonant that moment was and is in our politics today? Here's Newt Gingrich on Fox News talking about the impeachment investigation that's underway right now.
We are as close to a cultural civil war as we have been since the 1860s. You have people very deeply divided. They have literally lived in two different realities. And I think that you have sort of the pro-impeachment left desperate to get to Trump, led by the New York Times and the Washington Post and the major networks. Then you have millions of people for whom Trump is the first president to really stand up for what they think their values are.
So I don't know that I heard any conversation before Buchanan in 92 about the cultural war. I'm sure it was out there in some places, maybe among the Birchers, for instance, but Buchanan put it in the dialogue, and it's still there today.
Yeah, it's the early 90s that we you know, the historians talk about that term coming into common usage, and you know, Buchanan was one of the, obviously he invokes it there. He also, importantly, we couldn't listen to the whole thing, but there's a really dark passage at the end where he talks about the 92. Riots
in
Los Angeles. That's right, and it's a very ominous close to that. You know, anybody can go and listen to that speech. It's on YouTube, and they should go and listen to the whole thing because it's a fascinating and disturbing historical document.
Yeah, and you see it. I mean, I can't remember. Well, it must have been both Trump's speech at the Republican convention in 16, and again, his inaugural address took on similar ominous tones. You know, the nation is on the precipice of something bad, and I'm going to be the one to right the ship. And, you know, as a millennial who frankly was hearing that Nixon speech and the Buchanan speech for the first time, the Nixon one was so much more jarring for me. In this climate, being on Capitol Hill, hearing the sorts of language that Buchanan used, That's a Tuesday for me. Hearing the Nixon stuff, you know, nothing against you.
I am so glad we were able to contribute to your political education today.
You could argue, though, that it's this speech, or certainly it's this wing of the Republican Party that leads George W. Bush to create kind of compassionate conservatism, which is kind of a hallmark of his presidency. And it was in response to this wing, this kind of culture war wing.
Then what happened?
Well, George W. Bush serves two terms, but George W. Bush, you know, in retrospect, seems like a very moderate candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, George W. Bush also puts in place an immigration reform bill that, you know, is struck down by the right wing of the party. So you know, there was a lot of reaction against Bush, too, that we forget about.
We are unfortunately running short of time, but I do want to try one other thing here, Joe, with the little time we have remaining, and that's this. We focused an awful lot on how political elected officials, political leaders have enhanced partisanship or built up this partisanship that paralyzes us today, but we haven't talked about the responsibility that those of us as citizens have in all of this. And my example of that is what we call the big sort. And that has to do with how we as people now live our lives, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the Big Sort is a book written by a journalist that's kind of consolidating a lot of social scientific research that shows that people do live, we live in our bubbles, you know, not only online, but actually in our physical neighborhoods. And part of this is a consequence of rising educational levels that have happened since the World War II. You have so many more people who are going to four-year colleges, getting higher degrees. You would think that when you get more education, you become more broad-minded. But actually, that's not what happens. You get more education, and you become more kind of secure in your own view of the world. And so with education, education also creates opportunities for mobility, and people are more likely to move different places to get jobs and go for jobs. And so people are moving, they're more mobile, they're moving into areas where people see the world like they do, you know, so that we see, you know, we see it right here in Atlanta. You know, I live in Decatur, right? It's hard to find Republicans in Decatur,
yeah.
But it's also hard to find, you know, any Democrats in a lot of those northern arc suburbs. So it's part of our everyday reality.
Tom Faust, we had a post. This is, we're talking about Paul Taylor, who used to be a correspondent, was their lead political correspondent. I used to travel with Paul in earlier presidential races, went to the Pew Center for Research and wrote this piece on the demographic trend that are shaping American politics back in 2016, and it's still relevant today. So if we can post that, that'd be great, because I think people would be really interested in reading what Paul had to say. Tomorrow he talks about it, not just in terms of neighborhoods we live in, but the graying of America, which represents one part of who we are, the growing non-majority population, the minority population that's growing, and any number of other factors which are contributing to us as citizens becoming more divided.
Exactly. Millennials becoming now the bigger voting share, the bigger share of the workforce, and all of a sudden our boomer parents are starting to retire and don't like the way things are looking.
Yeah. Well, this is such an interesting discussion. I wish we could keep talking about it, but unfortunately, we have to get out of the way so that Terry Gross and Fresh Air can step in. But it's really been terrific. Tamar Hallerman, thank you for being here. And I'm very excited about the fact that you're going to be moving to Atlanta, and we hope to have you in our studios talking with us as often as we can do that.
Definitely.
Thanks. And Joe Crispino, really fun talking with you. You and I have discussed the fact that, you know, every month, 6 weeks, whatever, we're going to look for ways in which we can take what's happening today and put it in historical context. This is a great example of why that's a worthwhile thing to do.
We'd love to do it, Bill, anytime.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Thank you all for listening to the show today. I'm Bill Nygut. We're back tomorrow. Of course, we'll be talking about the Democratic debate. Theron Johnson will be here, Dr. Andre Gillespie, Heath Garrett. They're going to have a lot to say about the debate. We're also going to look at the financial statements of major candidates for office in Georgia, all that and more on tomorrow's show at 2:00.